Hey folks, welcome to Unsung Podcast. My name is Mark. Hi, joined by
Chris.
Hello.
Hi Chris. What have you been doing for the last week?
Hey, hello.
Learning Finnish.
Hello. What have you been doing for last week, just apart from learning Finnish?
That was literally it. One week to learn two variations of hello.
Two variations of
God,
hello.
I fucking love how many languages just have a sort of cheerier sounding version of hello.
Hi. That's it in Danish. Hi.
Hi. Hall.
Hi.
Hello.
German.
Hello.
Hello.
Anyway, yep, I have been, I took a trip back in time to,
oh, back to
high school
sorts.
Disco, yeah, where my father met my mother.
I don't know if I can show these on camera, can I? No, I don't think I can.
Are you going back to Future Socks?
I'll wear them, yeah. Look.
I wonder if I'd secretly saw that.
Maybe it was like, yeah. And was...
Actually, in the last episode, did I not mention a band called DeLorean?
Maybe. Did you see that? I don't know.
Did you not even...
No, maybe a little bit. No, that's shite.
Did you not even twig when I said DeLorean?
No.
Here, by the way, I'm wearing DeLorean socks. Hang on, let's double check here. DeLorean fucking is Finnish black metal pioneers of the 1990s, Black Doom. DeLorean.
Wow.
You should have leapt off that couch in front of the cat.
Look at that, what's the chances?
What are the chances?
Ah.
And I've got my special socks on in honour of the Wandering Midget.
The Wandering Midget. Wow, what a band, what a band.
Yeah. Right, so if you didn't see the first episode or hear the first episode,
see's
a thing,
wow.
Man. See is a
wow.
thing.
It was just the way you did it so quickly, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Not a lot of that part will make sense to you. If you did see it, still might not make sense to you. If you don't like our accents, it definitely won't make sense to you. If you are a first-time caller from Finland, you probably are struggling a wee bit with our diction.
Yeah.
But welcome.
Dick.
I don't know how to say welcome. Hello. Yeah, we're going to do part two of our Finland / Oranssi Pazuzu somewhat
Odyssey.
Deepish dive. Before we do that, we have to do the admin because this is a second episode.
Yeah.
Do it.
Let's do it. So if you're a fan of this podcast and you're not yet subscribed on Patreon, why not?
Tell you what, Paul Gleason better ask that question.
You better have asked that question.
Otherwise we might consider stopping accepting your money.
We won't do that. We might, but we probably won't. So yeah, if you're a fan of this podcast, you can go to patreon.com/unsungpod. And if you go there, you'll be able to sign up to one of two subscription options. The first one is £4 a month or whatever your equivalent local currency is. And you'll get access to a AAA Facebook group, which Chris just mentioned, mm-hmm. where you can meet the brand new Paul Gleason. Hi, Paul. You can get access to our episodes a couple of days early. You can get access to our bonus episodes, which includes, as Chris also alluded to, this year's Christmas episodes.
Can we just point out, as a bit of an upsell here, the Christmas episodes are usually among the best episodes of the year, especially because it's a tradition that we get a bit steaming.
And you can't see it in person.
Not in person.
You don't want to be here in person.
I'm a wee bit concerned about
it. It's going to smell horrible.
David will be back for it. We'll be taking some voice notes in from other hosts and guests over the year. But you want some provocative questions, don't you?
Yeah, you do.
You want some provocative questions.
Some of the most provocative questions you can
I've already got one in mind.
You do?
Yeah.
You want to ask yourself a question?
I want to ask us, what is the best song called Power of Love?
Oh.
And then we can fight that one out. There's three of us. Maybe we'll all pick a different one.
I think my cards are already on the table with this one, you know, with my socks.
Oh, Huey Lewis. I think my general demeanour and lifestyle suggests that I'm a Frankie Goes to Hollywood type. Somebody's got to take Jennifer Rush.
You're just too damn loud.
Yeah.
That's another deep cut for Back to the Future.
Anyway, Christmas episode, get your questions in. They don't have to be music related at all, really. You can just be a cheeky bugger if you want.
Yeah, we encourage it.
Yeah, especially those ones we'll probably leave till later in the show once we're a bit, you know,
merry.
A bit finished. Yep, sorry Finland, but you're the only country that Scottish people get to also make fun of for drinking too much,
yeah.
Because we have to put up with that shit all the time because we are notorious for it. Well, bad news. So are you. So, you know.
I think there's probably only, there's three other countries, I think, which probably drink just as much as Scotch. Russia, which we don't want to talk about, which is why you guys get Ireland.
Yeah.
And Japan.
There, I mean, no, but I mean.
I mean, come on. What are they called? Company men? After work, every day in a karaoke bar, getting smashed.
I think culturally, yeah. We do know
they've got a huge alcohol problem.
Aye. But I mean, so does England.
I suppose, I think I conflated England, Scotland and UK there, which is a massive faux pas. Massive
You're saying that like that's not a big deal.
That's a huge deal. I can't believe I fucking did that. Sorry, yeah. The UK have got a huge drinking problem, generally.
Scotland gets more shit for it, though, than England. Yeah.
Unless you live in Spain, particularly in the coastal areas.
Yeah, no, they do have to put up with a lot of drunk English people. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, so Finland, sorry I'm making fun of your drinking habits and your basically really serious national epidemic, but we've got one too, so lol. I'm punching across.
Yeah,
so we're going to talk about Aranci Pazuzu now, please.
Wait, no, we're not.
No.
One more thing we talk about.
Uh-oh.
If we go to the second tier of our Patreon.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Join the record club. Uh-huh. We basically go out and find great records by underground bands. We buy them directly from the bands or their independent labels. And your subscription fee gets split between them, us, and then you get the benefit of once a month, you get this lovely little surprise. And it will be kind of tailored to your tastes to some extent. We've got a great library of stuff. We've got some brilliant bands. Most of the people that are on that love it. And it doesn't, they hopefully don't just enjoy that record. It switches them on to entire new scenes. Because a lot of people, like most musicians, are in different bands. Basically, it'll broaden your horizons, mm-hmm. is what we're saying. And we are taking this stuff from all corners of the world, taking recommendations. If, by the way, you're someone listening to this and you've got some hot recommendations because you've been deep diving on Bandcamp and you've found some awesome stuff, then yeah, link it to us. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be the first one to get into the record club on that basis. So.
And particularly if you're Finnish.
Yeah, it'd be good to get some Scandinavian stuff. We'd have a lot on there. So can I do the show now?
Go for it.
All right, it's time. We're going back in. Last week, we did basically a whistle stop tour of Finland to talk about where it came from.
Where did Finland come from?
Yeah. Mainly just dropped off by a glacier, exactly where it's at. How it managed to survive as Finland, to become it and survive it, winter war, all that kind of stuff in the 50s, 40s, 50s, all that kind of period, created a lot of tension with Russia. It's a very dark and foreboding place. Everybody's in national in the national reserve. Very militarised country, despite being frequently voted the world's cheeriest as a result.
Hello! So,
yeah, very dark. Full of booze, at least two asylums for the criminally insane.
Mm-hmm. Existential angst out the arse.
Absolutely. And just hunters and hunters and hunters of metal. The highest proportion of metal bands per capita in the world.
In the world.
So yeah, Finland, really interesting place. Really pretty affluent. Very progressive. Even just the fact that they, you know, their kids are watching like Heavisaurus, and they're just exposed to just the sort of stuff that our kids are just they don't get that kind of like cultural diversity. Yeah. So as a result, huge black metal scene, huge doom scene, huge power metal scene, just huge metal scene in general. We're trying to hone in. Well, not so much in the black metal scene because we've covered that in a past episode, but in the doom scene, because those two elements in particular influenced this week's band, Aranci Pazuzu. And I would encourage you once more, please go back and listen to the black metal episode, especially if you're a newcomer to the pod. It was definitely one of our highlights of those first couple of years. We spent a lot of time on it and I think you'll dig it. And it will inform this a little bit. But we're going to talk about the album Mestarin Kynsi, or Kynsi. Aranci Pazuzu, as we introduced in the last episode, largely from an area called Tampere. Now, we also did a wee bit on that last week because Tampere has this like little kind of district in it with this one practice facility that has all these bands gathered around it, and it's led to these bands sort of jamming with each other and all these things coming out really disproportionately influential in the scene over there. Mm-hmm. So check that bit out as well. But Aranci Pazuzu, for me now, they weren't always, but for now they are the leading lights of that scene. It's a five-piece group. Members are Koryak, Icon, Evil, Onto, and Junhis. There's an ex-member, Moit, who's on some of this stuff as well. The name, if you'll remember, we said that Aranci's orange, and Pazuzu is a Mesopotamian deity, a wind god. And it turns out the one that possesses Reagan in The Exorcist.
Yep.
That is canon, I believe. Aranci Pazuzu. We also commented on the fact that Aranci Pazuzu sound really fucking evil.
Evil.
Not just in the fact that they do loads of scary voices, because as we said, you know, metal is quite tongue-in-cheek. Mm-hmm. It is quite pantomime-y, but there is something about Aranci Pazuzu, the intensity of the music, the fact that they bring so many disorientating elements to it. A lot of psychedelia in it, yeah. There's a lot of electronica, there's loads of very long songs, very densely produced and delivered, loads of dissonance. There is something really quite nauseating at times and a bit overpowering in their music, especially if you've got it in your ears.
Foreboding.
Yeah. So I genuinely think they are a band that does sometimes cross that threshold about, ooh, am I still having a good time? Mm-hmm. You know, this isn't the tongue-in-cheek schlock metal of like Iron Maiden where you're just having a whale of a time, or, you know, there's something really quite troubling about it.
Yeah, there's no tongue-in-cheekness about this band.
Yeah. We also mentioned that some of their themes include the horror of the void, you know, outer space. There's a lot of, like, cosmic horror.
A bit Lovecraftian, I think.
It is a wee bit, aye. And just despairing, you know, the giant unknown vacuum, the infinite terror, the terror of an infinite cosmos, as they say. Musically, we talked about the fact they just have such a broad palette, not just of their own sound, but in terms of the influences that come into the band. Now, in terms of what I hear when I listen to Aranci Pazuzu more generally, I'll throw in a few categories here, okay? So I would say there's bits of like really feral mid-1980s noise scene. We've talked about this in the show before. The one that kind of grew like a fucking gleeful tumour out of punk rock. So you got Throbbing Gristle. You've got acts like White House. Quite controversial, certainly very extreme kind of noise projects, experimental stuff like Nurse with Wound. You've also got really alternative, acerbic stuff like Stretch Heads. Scottish band, classic band from that era. I think you have the cold post-punky croutiness of people like Suicide. You have some of that mid-period of Wire. Now, we've got a Wire double episode back in the archives, and there was this phase in Wire where they went from being this kind of fun post-punk band to being something really fucking weird and experimental and sometimes very cold and challenging. Mm. You've also got Cabaret Voltaire, probably the late 70s era. It tracks like Heaven and Hell. It's really disturbing music. I mean, Cabaret Voltaire are one of these bands that went through a lot of different iterations and sounds, but I think that period in particular is very challenging again. And I think an obvious thing to throw in there would be like industrial metallic stuff. So Swans.
Swans is a good one.
Swans come up and reference this band a lot, also because of the sprawling nature of their music. Ministry. Obviously not early Ministry, but some of the more challenging, noise-based, dissonant later stuff. And one that I think is a really good reference is Einstürzende Neubauten. If you listen to tracks like Armenia, for example, you hear that really caustic side to that band. Yeah. And so when we're talking about Aranci Bazouzi, we're not just throwing in the usual fucking, oh, they sound a bit like Mayhem and Dark Throne mixed with Cult of Luna or an earlier group like Sabbath or, you know, it's not just like doom and black metal combined together with a little bit of post-rock in it and stuff. There's a lot more, and the electronic elements are huge.
There's definitely, I think, elements of that early post-hardcore slinty Spiderland, you know, in terms of how they let things breathe and be unsettling and that.
They also like a really dissonant bent guitar string, and that's like a real feature of the noise rock movement.
Yeah, I was going to say there's a bit of that. There's also, there's some guitar lines that are very post-hardcore-y as well. Mm-hmm. And the industrial thing, I actually hear a lot of the textures and sounds of Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah.
Specifically, there's some synth tones and guitar tones that are taken right out of a Nine Inch Nails like back catalogue.
I think there's a couple of moments that really remind me of the Fragile as well, that kind of period, and the kind of slightly higher production periods of Aranci have moments of that.
Because I think the thing you mentioned about Nine Inch Nails, the reason I bring it up, and as separately from all that industrial noise stuff, is that everybody knows that Reznor's got a very specific tone, and they do incorporate that. And I like hearing that in odd places. I like hearing that in new places, because if you're an Nine Inch Nails fan, nobody else copies it wholesale ever, really. But when it comes into something you don't expect, it's like, oh, that's definitely something for Reznor. So
I found a really interesting article where they actually talked about some of their influences. But it's interesting when you go to do one of these episodes and you think you know a band and you realise you don't actually know that much about them. You know, you've enjoyed listening to their music, but you don't really know any of the lore or the where they came from or the origin story of them. And so learning a bit about them is quite interesting, because I had them, I don't know, I think I was a bit confused about what kind of band this is, because musically they really don't sound like so many metal bands, yet they do. They're clearly a metal band. They are clearly a metal band, but there's just so much more going on there.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think it's any exaggeration to say, I literally think this is one of the most exciting and innovative bands going about just now. Now, because, especially because of the vocal style, it's going to be an acquired taste, because that witchy, goblin-y, extreme thing, it's very OTT. And there have been bands in the past where that's totally alienated me. But I feel like it works in this band. And I think it works in this band because the music is precisely so much more complicated and interesting and intricate that the vocals are almost like you've taken an element from a different genre and deliberately put it into this new context to see how it works. And it feels really fresh as a result of that.
Yeah.
Even though it's a well-trodden path doing that style of vocal, to hear it in this context to me is just very refreshing.
Yeah.
I know people that musically would really enjoy this, that as soon as he opens his mouth might just be like, oh no, that's not for me. That's not for me. You're not going to get hooks. You're not going to get singing bits. It's really just it's a texture.
It is. Well, that's what I was going to say. Texture's the word. The vocals are another instrument. They're not a centrepiece. I think in a lot of metal music, the vocal is the centrepiece because it has hooks. It's not necessarily obvious hooks, or there's a focus particularly on lyrics and how they're delivered and all that. You don't really get that. It just becomes another paint in the collage of their music.
So yeah, I find myself like a wee bit blind as to what's actually musically going on with this band. And so doing this episode has been quite enlightening, I think, because I have listened to them a lot And yet I've never been exposed to the behind the scenes of it. So I found this article in Decibel magazine from 2020 when they brought this album out, actually. And Onto and Icon had picked out 10 albums that they said had wielded a kind of disproportionate influence over the entirety of the band, not just them. So I'll go through that because it's pretty interesting. So some of these I know, some of these I don't know. And the first one was Psychic Paramount, who I don't know, with an album called Two, presumably their second album. Described by the band as electronic music played by a trio that used traditional rock instruments to sound like a supercomputer, which is something I'm really a big fan of, even with my own music as well, is when people take instruments and try and do electronic things with them. You know, just obviously a lot of music is driven by laptops now and backing tracks and stuff. So hearing bands that are doing it the other way is pretty fascinating. And certainly the way Oranzi Pazuzu integrate electronics, it still feels very organic, feels very played. Yeah, there are a couple of arpeggiators, but the arpeggiators don't feel like they're set to some sort of rigid backing track. They feel like they come in over the top and are sort of manually worked. A band that they cited, Boredoms. Japanese band, a record called Vision Creation New Sun, which they called the ultimate psychedelic album, like blocks of sound hammered over tribal drum loops and makes you feel like there are no rules in music. That's a really interesting thing because Boredoms are kind of that sort of eccentric Japanese project that really just rejected most sensible parameters. They did whatever the fuck they wanted. They did one at the Brooklyn, a show at the Brooklyn Bridge once that was a spiral of drum kits. I mean, like, I can't remember the exact number, but we're talking like 60, 70 drum kits set up in a spiral playing this pattern. And I mean, they just do this really eccentric stuff. Like, and to say that they make you feel like there are no rules in music is a pretty fair assessment. I don't always think they're the most musically rewarding, but in terms of what they maybe enable in other musicians, such as this, then they're to be commended. The third one they said was The Soft Machine in Volume 2. A big influence on the rapid changes in Mr. and Kinsey, because that album does shift about quite a lot, and The Soft Machine were a band that would like just change a part into something else. I think Onto had said that they have so much fuzz that they make the average stoner rock band pale in comparison. And I think that record in particular is quite known for that. The bass especially was really fucking saturated. A band called Circle, who I think, yeah, they're a Finnish band. Like, I think they're described here as a hypnotic pioneering Finnish band, a record called Tantumus. They eventually went full spandex, apparently, but at this point, this was a kind of quite cyclical, like repetitive, hypnotic record, Tantumus. They've got Miles Davis in here. Bitches Brew. Actually, I've seen a lot of jazz references to them.
I mean, there's a lot of jazz chords and stuff used in their music. Yeah, you know? I get that.
So, but what's interesting in terms of their analysis of Miles Davis's influence is not so much the playing, but, quote, it manifests paranoia perfectly and gives the impression that you're running away from something terrifying. Which is like, I'm not a big Miles Davis listener. I mean, we've done Miles Davis on the show before, and I didn't take that from it. But to hear him, like especially Bitches Brew, which is a famous record by him.
I can actually hear some of that when I think about it.
Like,
you know,
it's dripping with paranoia.
I wouldn't say if it's dripping with paranoia, but there's definitely a paranoia to some parts of it for sure. It's all largely improvised, you know what I mean? So it's going to bring in, and I guess if you're high as fuck, there's going to be moments of that you know, when you're playing improvising, yeah, that's going to come in.
Psychedelics are playing a big part here. There's a band called Wigwam, a record called Being. Wigwam are described as the pinnacle of 70s Finnish prog, and there is a lot of prog in this band.
Do Wigwam do the theme song for Peacemaker?
I have no idea.
Do you really want to taste it? I think they do. It's a massive cock rock song. Really good song.
Okay, cool.
Is that the have you seen that Peacemaker, the John Cena DC TV show, directed by James Gunn? It's got an opening sequence which you should definitely watch on YouTube if you haven't. It's just a big dance number with the whole cast, including John Cena, dancing to this song. It's a lot of fun.
We've got My Bloody Valentine, and specifically actually the record EPs 88 to 91, as opposed to, you know, the more obvious album. They describe that as a perfect blend between beautiful soundscapes and painful noise. And yeah, certainly the extremely saturated nature of My Bloody Valentine, you know, blew the doors open for a lot of people back in the 80s in terms of what they could do with their
shoegaze sound. The shoegaze band.
Yeah. Portishead, third.
There's a lot of trip hop vibes across their music.
So third, we've got an entire episode about this album. It's a fucking masterpiece, and I was really pleased to see it make an appearance here. And it did actually click when I was listening through again. I was like, oh, I hear it now. Yeah, yeah.
Because I like DJ Shadow. It did pop out to me a few times, and it is in my notes as well.
So apparently that was a big inspiration, especially with regards to the production and the choice of tones on Mester and Kunse. The second last one they picked out was King Crimson's Red.
Can he be a proggy band without having a King Crimson record?
Yeah, totally. I mean, they're fucking masters of it. But also that album in particular is a really interesting one. Not the obvious choice, you know, Court of the Crimson Kings usually. Yeah. The kind of thing people go to. But they said a certain lo-fi-ness found in those early live recordings just emphasises how heavy, raw and merciless they could sound. And then the last one was Can with Tago Mago. They describe them as the definitive krautrock band.
Yeah.
Incredible grooves. And krautrock, as we mentioned in the first episode, is a huge part of what Aransi Pazuzu do.
It's interesting. Something I didn't write in my notes, which I was thinking at the time. So I'm not au fait with krautrock. I've not really listened to much Can. But a couple of times when we've been doing episodes with bands that are kind of like that, you've often spoken about Motorik.
Yep.
And
it's a very specific style of krautrock.
Yeah. I thought I could hear that in some of the stuff, but I took out the reference to it because I was like, I'm not going to use a reference to something I don't know a huge amount about. But there were definitely some Krauter moments where it is just a couple of songs, actually, which are just a repetition of a pattern over and over and over again with a vocal or a slightly different synth or whatever, you know.
Okay, well, I guess, you know, at least with a wee bit of insight, it helps us pick apart some of their catalogue. So we look at that catalogue.
Yeah, cool.
We're doing this catalogue on the understanding that Aransi Pazuzu do use psychedelics in their production and writing processes. That actually seems pretty obvious in hindsight. But I would say that given their music, I'm in two minds about the potential wisdom of listening to it on psychedelics. You described in the first episode
it's
as a bad trip.
It's a bad trip.
That's the thing. I'm like, can this music go any way other than a bad trip?
No. I'm Absolutely not.
Okay, so, and what I did do, by the way, for this episode,
I have a bad trip.
Is not well, it was a wee bit of a bad trip trying to pronounce some of these titles. So for the Finns, I have tried to take a note of how they're pronounced.
So sure, they'll appreciate that.
I hope this works. So Mukalainen Pahu. It was a debut from 2009. It translates as Alien Speaks. Well, that's a literal translation. I'm not sure that's what they're going for. I don't know if it's like alien language or alien communication, something like that, but Alien Speaks. This album was actually recorded in a family cabin.
Sounds like it.
Remotely. I think that being the case, they did a damn fine job of it. The drums are a bit timid compared to the later efforts, but I think when you see the context, that's understandable. The first track in it, Corpi, is a simple but highly recognisable riff in their catalogue. And the third one, Kingastus 1968, is a psychedelic 70s prog thing. Heavy on the organ, minus the extreme distortion, that I think seems like probably the most blatant foray into King Crimson terrain. I don't think this album's the best work, but if you like the band, it's very unlikely you'll dislike it.
I hate this record with a passion.
Wow.
So on Spotify, it comes out in 2017, which is obviously reissued, so it's in between. So by this point, I'd heard a lot of more hi-fi stuff, which is a lot more atmospheric and soundscapey.
You heard them out of sequence.
So when I heard this out of sequence, I was like, this is fucking dreadful. I did not like this record at all. It's 270s for me. It doesn't go far enough in the directions that I enjoy. So I think my opinion of it is tainted by the thought of where I listened to it, just on the digital discography. If I listened to it first, I would have known when I started my journey, which I probably should have looked in fucking Wikipedia or Discogs or something. I would have maybe had a different opinion of it, but because of where it sat for me, I just took nothing from it.
Okay, well, recorded in a cabin in the early days. I actually think if you get into the group, there's enough good stuff on it that you won't dislike it. But as Mark says, if you listen out of sequence, you may be in a spot of bother. So they followed that in sequence with a split EP with a group called Candy Cane. This from 2010. This is very nasty stuff. In terms of the Aransi Pazuzu stuff in it, the first track, Ole Mukalainen. I mean, it makes it sound like your fucking head is overloading, never mind the track. The sound is grimy as fuck. It's got a really crunchy low end as well, which is a big step forward for them sonically. The fourth track, Pharmacologisen Kulten Putarhasa. The late riff that appears after 4 minutes in that one is fucking minging. In a really good way. Overall, there are some fun synth piano organ ideas in that one that bode well for the future, although they maybe aren't always landing quite right yet. But, you know, they're clearly trying stuff. But yeah, the four tracks on that are a really brutal listen in a very good way. It's good stuff.
I didn't listen to it because I was a bit wary after hearing the first album. So I didn't go back to it.
Oh, no, it's decent. It's sonically a lot harsher. A lot harsher.
Okay,
So 2011, their second album proper is Cos Monument. A lengthy 66-minute outing. Yeah. music said of this one, the group's sophomore full length was a conceptual affair about a drifter lost in the void and the record that put them on the map with fans across the Atlantic. So immediately, talking about that cosmic kind of horror, the infinite void thing starting to appear here. The first track in this one, actually, Siene Pilvi, starts in a kind of, it's much more akin to sort of blackened doom, totally misanthropic and unrelentingly grim, that track. Points for the church bells, by the way. I fucking love a well-placed church bell these days. The second track in it, Cometa, is quite a prominent one for them. It has that tremoloed guitar of black metal, you know, the really speed kind of pick thing, but with a clarity that brings it very much closer to psychedelic rock. I really like the intermittent seasick lead guitar part in this. The only thing I'm not convinced about is there's a kind of jaunty upstroke hi-hat thing in the chorus, but apart from that, really interesting bit of music. And the third one on that, Usi Olento Nusa, is a blasty minor key black metal beast. This really hideous sludgy ending. The record does seem to kind of get left out of discussions of their better work, and I get why. It feels a bit scattered, but it does have some really cool ideas in it. It definitely has the air of a band trying on some new clothes to see what fit, you know. And I think that track, Cometa, is a really good example of that.
I thought Cometa was brilliant. It feels like a huge step forward in the sound to me. It's more angular, it's more genre bending than anything in the first album. The verses to me almost feel quite post-hardcore-y. And yeah, the tremolo guitars are black metal-y, but it also felt more post-rocky to me than black metal, so it was a really nice little sort of dichotomy there. Just generally better use of atmospherics in that song too. Malfitimo is quite spacey. It's actually got some really interesting chords that you wouldn't really find in metal. A lot of jazzy stuff, like I said earlier on. There's a middle bit with like heavily delayed guitar solo that transitions into a really sick bass riff, which I really, really enjoyed there as well. Yeah.
So 2013, after that, they brought out Valonielu. I don't know where the emphasis is. It's either Valonielu or Valonielu. Yep, the name. I was really trying to track down the name and the meaning of the name in this one. I found one in-context use of it. The sentence went, if Valonielu was the creation of a universe, Varatelia is the magnification and expansion of its infinite boundaries. And by Varatelia happens to be the name of the next record, so I don't know if that's sort of relevant. However, it could also translate as the Walloons. Do you know the Walloons? They're the French-speaking people of Belgium.
Okay.
So if you go to, like, in Paris, there's a Valonielle Société. But that seems less likely to be the meaning. but yeah, there you go. Anyway, at this point, the band have already turned some heads. This record saw them going to London to work with producer Jim Gomez Arellano, which gives it a different feel and a higher fidelity. In terms of a couple of standout moments, the second track here, Taya Tempeli. This is something truly different, dramatic, cinematic, with a vibe that's more evocative of like the sprawling American Midwest. It's got big flavours of Ennio Morricone and those resonant bent guitar lines. There's a lot of nods to Godspeed You Black Emperor in this one. And it's all obviously smeared with that ragged, echoing vocal style. Really different and really fucking good, that song. Mm-hmm. And the fifth one stood out, Olin Avanot Uden Silman. Seems to be initially like a long black metal workout, but it takes this dramatic and fairly brilliant 90 degree turn at 2 minutes when it shifts into this rolling kraut.
Yeah,
it's a bit of a masterpiece. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think the guitars are really pared back again, and the music just slowly accumulates weight over the next 2 minutes, you know, just picking up wee bits here and there. Production wise the record itself is brighter and clearer, which helps the music given how much is going on in it. They're also a band that makes a lot of use of the harsher areas of the frequency spectrum, you know, so in that sense, with better higher end on the recordings, things cut sharper, it feels more toothy. I would say, though, recording-wise, whilst it's an improvement, it's still some way short of that sonic maximalism that's going to follow.
Yeah, for me, those two tracks you mentioned were two that I picked out, which is really good, but I really enjoyed the first track, Vino Verso. Mm-hmm. It's got a fantastic riff, just a really great riff, this offset with really freaky synths. And that riff is played for the whole song, you know, so it does have that crowd rock feel to it, right, which is cool. And it starts to become quite hypnotic as a result of that. And the vocals and the synths shift around it, which makes for a really interesting texture. The other one I liked was Relka Mice and Massa. It's a very laid back kind of menacing song, like a twisted 70s jazz song almost. It reminds me of Tom Waits in his most unsettling moments, which I quite enjoyed.
So yeah, 2016 they brought out Varahelia, which by the way translates as oscillator. It's a 69 minute monster, and that's maybe not surprising given that it has songs that run up to 17 minutes on it.
This is the opening track.
Yeah, this is the album where things really shifted for the band. It's also potentially the album that I think a lot of other people might have backed for this episode, and that includes none other than David John Weaver. David John Weaver sadly no longer with us, but sending us voice notes from the next world about Aransi Pazuzu. Will we take a listen?
Yes.
Hello boys, hope you're well. Hope you can hear me alright. I'm just currently out walking the dog. It's quite chilly. But yes, I fucking love Aransi Pazuzu. I think genuinely one of the best heavy bands in the world right now. I can't really think of many bands that are sort of taking on such a wealth of influences and coming up with a sound that is so sort of original and unique right now, very uniquely them. Yeah, it's weird that the new record actually this year came out either on the same week or the week after Blood Incantation's record. I mean, I love Blood Incantation. They're like a total step above most death metal. Their new record is like this mad, glorious, sort of old school cosmic death metal album. Big dollops of prog, kraut, jazz, electronic, all recorded very sort of vintagely on analog kit and stuff, and it's all quite sort of boldly and deliberately paying homage, I guess, and you know, but it's still death metal, so even when death metal is sort of cerebral, it's and based in literature, which the new Blood Incantation record is, it's still sort of trashy pulp, cerebral. Yes, it's great that they're not talking about just brutal murders and serial killers, but they are just talking like sort of stoned students who've seen 2001 for the first time. But then Oranssi Pazuzu come out with a new record, their sixth album, which is, I think, all six records are class, and it fuses metal, kraut, doom, post-rock, jazz, but it's not like over the top or silly, it's just fucking amazing. And I think it's possibly better than the Blood Incantation record. I think they're probably two of my top five albums. But yeah, I guess Oranssi are rooted in black metal rather than death metal, so they've got a much more sort of nihilistic, evil sound. I think that's kind of what stands out throughout their whole discography. It's just this, like, atmosphere, total evil vibes. But not, like, theatrical. It's, like, genuine, dark, cold winter. I think they're maybe a band that, I mean, all the records are so good, it's probably the situation where the first one you hear becomes your favourite. Chris, I know Mistrin Kinsai was the first one you heard, because I remember sending it to you, and I remember you said that a bunch of people had sent it to you, so it obviously stood out as like a, Chris is going to love this record. And obviously it's sort of developing those krauty influences, chunkier bass, so yeah, very much had Chris stamped on it. Totally amazing record, was probably my favourite of 2020, but I think I have to say that the album before, Varhatilesia is my favourite record. First one I heard about them, it's just proper evil, maybe less kraut, a bit more doom, there's some proper black metal on it, but there's so much space, so much build up, just got some of the biggest doomiest riffs I've ever heard. The central song on that album, Vasiman Kadan Hairaka, is just this 17 minute monster that takes you in, sort of builds and builds and then just absolutely destroys you slowly and brutally. Yeah, fucking love that album. It's timeless, it sort of sounds like nothing I've heard before, but also if it turned out that it was secretly created by a mad group of Finns in a forest tripping on acid in 1968, then I wouldn't actually be that surprised. So yeah, that's my favourite record, but I'll back any of them, to be honest. Yeah, Oranssi managed to sort of get that progressive black metal bleakness of like Ulvar or like Portal, take away any black metal cringe, add like the analog joy and rhythm of really good kraut like Can, and then like add like good bits of prog, like the non-shit parts of Pink Floyd and Tool, and then also add like the modern sort of nihilistic doom of Pelican or even like The Body. Yeah, fucking best band, love them, and great record. All records by them are great.
I just want to shout out there that the Blood Incantation record he's talking about is fucking tremendous as well. It's very, very good. There's actually a track with Tangerine Dream on it, and it is not at all a death metal track, but it is very oppressive.
Why not? How many worlds are there?
Then they have bits of the most brutal death metal you've ever heard. Like, none of the melodic death stuff, like actual punishing, you know. It is a really great record. I think there's only four or five tracks on it, but they're all really fucking long. A good album.
Dave walking his dog up the summit of K2.
Yeah,
sounds like it. Yeah, I mean, Dave's right. We do have that kind of, not recency bias, but sort of debut bias. You know, when you come to a band via a certain album, sometimes it just sort of ends up being the one that you're always leaning towards. I think in his case, though, it's not a coincidence, because Varahelia does seem like it's a real step forward. Yes. I think probably they went much further on it musically, and I think they were duly rewarded. It was issued in February 2016 to pretty much universal acclaim. The median score across all publications is still 90% and above. I think it'd actually be interesting to look at some of the reaction to it as well, because it played a huge part in the fate of this band. You know, it is the thing that seemed to have kind of stepped them up from being potential contenders to, all right, they've made a breakthrough. So I don't think it is that Dave's just been biased. I think there is really something distinct about this record. So, for example, in the Album of the Year fan rankings, this one places top, and my one, Mr. Inkinsey, is in third. Metal Music Archives also has it at the top of its fan lists. At the time, Spin Magazine said of this one, "To date, they've built three solid records on an inversion of the genre, but with their fourth album, they've finally made a record that fully follows through on the paradoxical promise of their component parts. Their blackening of the synth explorations and the cosmic instrumentals that come with the 70s prog they borrow from provides a breath and life to even that rarefied air." Now, this is the only one of their albums that Pitchfork reviewed. They gave it a 7.9, which is good coming from Pitchfork. And they said, "Arancy Pazuzu's step out of metal, though, finds them burrowing deeper into a world of their own creation. Varahelia is a weird, grotesque record where genres are superimposed on one another and where eccentric choices are the rule and not the exception." The superimposing the genres was quite an interesting turn of phrase in that sense. Louder Sound included it in their list of 10 essential post-black metal albums, saying, "Building on the strengths of three progressively wilder albums, 2016 saw Arancy Pazuzu notch a new high. Taking black metal's potential for mental and spiritual transportation a little too literally, they added more than colour on the manic vortex that is Varahelia, unifying far-out space rock with jazzy's lawless aesthetic on a kaleidoscopic musical journey, as terrifying as it is psychedelic. Arancy Pazuzu seemed determined to make you look at life from an alternate perspective, if you can find the courage to do so." And lastly, All Music says, "With this album, they added elements of krautrock, the electric voodoo funk of Miles Davis, stoner doom metal, thrash and post-metal to the sonic palette. Despite a wealth of 21st century psych overtones, Arancy Pazuzu's music is always blacker than most any other on the planet, thanks in no small part to the otherworldly, some would say satanic, vocals of founder and guitarist Junhis." So it's extra evil, it's hugely atmospheric, it's often brutally heavy. Yep. I totally agree with that. In terms of a couple of standout moments, my take, I think Hypnotisoitu, Viharukos, in particular, the fourth one, is an explosive black metal monster. It's got a terrific bass line and it really prominent.
Yep.
And the sixth one, Havulu, has an absolutely crushing second half. Whilst it also manages to be weirdly hypnotic. It's like, I don't know, like, remember Paul McKenna?
Yeah.
It's like him reversing a bus over you, but making constant eye contact via the wing mirrors.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, they have got to a point with the kraut stuff. They're not just repeating it for a groove. They're repeating it to get you into a false sense of security, to lure you in. Then sometimes they flip it on you to really good effect. I think the record is rightfully lauded for innovation and depth. However, I do actually personally find it a wee bit ponderous. It's long.
It is long.
It is long. Mm-hmm. It's certainly a bit of a masterpiece of atmospherics, and it is outstanding innovation, but in terms of sheer enjoyment, they have eclipsed it since, for me.
I thought it's a really good record. The track, the first track you pointed out there,
Try it.
Hypnotisio Varokis. That has got a class.
Hopefully one of us could need it.
That's got a class riff. The chord progression is great. It's heavy without being super dirty. One of one of the things I like about their guitar tones is they're not properly metal guitar tones. There's a bit of space to them, almost like they're on Telecasters or something like that, and not on high output pickups. I like the first track, Saturatio, really vibey. Huge step up in atmospherics from the last album. It's grander, it's got tons of ambition. I just love the way to let the song breathe. It's like 17 minutes long. It just slowly evolves over time. It moves from weird 70s psychedelia to esoteric crushing 2010s metal so effortlessly, and it does that via 2000s post rock and 90s alt rock. It's just a fucking fantastic bit of music, that.
Yeah.
And then I also like the title track as well. It's quite sinewy, it kind of slinks about in a bed of gothic guitars, and it's got a really moody bass, and it's really restrained compared to some of the other stuff, but as a result it works really well in the context of the record. But it is ponderous, it is a long album.
It's long, and yeah, long albums have to do something truly spectacular pretty consistently, and I just think there's just a few too many moments where it's a bit baggy. I think, to be honest, that's probably recency bias for me, because I came in on a 51 minute album and that felt right for the style of music for me. You know, it feels fresh. You get to the end of it, you're like, that flew by. Yeah, this one doesn't fly by for me. Now, they're not massively prolific in the sense that they tend to take 3 or 4 years with records for this kind of point. Trying to avoid losing momentum, they dropped a 2-track EP in 2017 called Kvat Varimirsky. The first track in that, Kvat, for me is actually fairly average, doomy, atmospherics, totally fine. They used that to kickstart their Live at Roadburn set of 2017. The second track, though, Varimirsky, is much more interesting. The first 3 minutes of it are of a similar ilk to Kvat, but they ramp up the tension. It bursts into this fully fledged psychotic krautrock tune at 3.5 minutes. The instrumentation morphs, it darkens, but that driving rhythm behind it almost never relents until just towards the very, very end it goes to a half time. I mean, it completely, this track justifies the krautrock tags that are put on them. It's a very, very good song.
Yeah, I didn't listen to it, so we can move on to
that. No, that I don't think Kvat is any great shakes, but the second track is. And talking of Live at Roadburn, now that was recorded in 2017. It was released in 2019. All Music has said that it documented what is now regarded as one of the most immersive and inspired outings in that festival's history. It is a great set. Despite lacking many of the stunning tracks on the subsequent albums, you mentioned Vino Verso earlier on. The album version of that for me is fine, it's good, but the live version is probably my highlight of the live set. The amazing off-time drum parts cut through a lot better, I think, in that live mix as well. Uh, 2020, they brought out Mester and Kinsey. We'll come back to that. And 2024, the main event here.
October.
Moon Tau Tuya. Shapeshifter, I believe, is the translation. Absolutely kicks the fuck out of the red line with this album. Like, so dense and intense and loud. There's a lot of very choice and very, very clever production in it. They often dial it back on other records, but I think this time it's less sprawling post-rock and a bit more trippy electronica that they go to.
Yeah, the trip-hop is in this one for sure.
I've picked out a few highlights of this one because I think it merits discussion. The first one, Bioalchemisti, it has a percussive push and the bass angles of a Jesus Lizard track, but forced through a fucking wood chipper.
That's interesting.
And just sprayed in your face. It's a really strong opening statement. The title track, Munta Tuya, has an openness, especially the drums in it are panned quite hard left, the snares panned hard left, and that production and the style of that, I mean, I can hear it, the resonance of it, it reminds me a bit of the Fragile era Nine Inch Nails.
That's what I kind of got from Bioalchemisti, the first track. It's got a weird 8-bit intro. I think we should highlight that. It has an 8-bit intro,
right,
which is cool. And then it becomes a really industrial feeling bass and drum section. And then it just becomes basically what I think is an Nine Inch Nails version of a black metal song. And I really enjoyed it for that. Got some really freaky female vocals in it as well, about 3 minutes 54, which sounded positively horrific for me in a good way. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's it was such pitch perfect for the song. And the other one I liked was Votel 2, which has singing in it, kind of. The singing's like super warped and processed and not distorted, but like layers of phaser and reverb and delay. And then when the gremlin vocals come in, it's very black metal-y. Some really nicely chosen piano, which is again resonating to me, because sometimes he'll bring out just a lovely classical piano.
Remember we talked about how Portishead's third really informed their tonal choices. I think you really hear that in this. So the fourth track on it, How Tatuli. This one, I think, really showcases that, and especially that weird loungy bass line and the sedate drum. The vocal in it as well, for the first time, the vocal feels really quite percussive. It's not hip-hoppy, but it's got a beat and a rhythm to it. And actually, to be honest, maybe I'm saying Portishead, it's maybe even closer to, you know, Jeff Barrow's other project, Beak, in recent years. I think the sixth track, Valhutis, which was a single, has a really fucking hideous grinding push beat and riff in it, and at 5 minutes 20 it just does this feral ultra saturated noise out ending, just super caustic thing to finish. A couple other very quick points. Iki Karmi plays dead for about 4 minutes, this track. It's just this dark dirge. And then it just erupts out of nowhere, about 4 minutes 40 in this huge riff. And the 8th track, which I think is the last one in this one, Vieriva Uzva, goes for a haunting electro orchestral thing. Actually, honestly, this album's very recent, mm-hmm. and I'm still getting used to it. And it takes a fair bit of chewing, but I think this makes a strong case for being considered their best work.
See, I was going to say, when I listened to this and then went back to the one album we're doing, I kind of still felt as though that one was better. I need to spend more time with it. Also, Unrate Your Music, it's actually the top rated one.
Is it?
But it has less reviews. Than the one that you've picked, yeah. which was the top rated. There's only 0.2 in it as well, so it's not like it's a huge amount.
I would be much more confident in saying that I think the new album is better than Varahelia. It's certainly a lot briefer as well, gets to the point.
It's like 46 minutes or 49 minutes or something like that. I think it's the shortest one.
I'm not quite at the point of being able to say that I think it's their best. I'm still going to stick with Mester and Kunze, but I think if this is the first one you hear, you might swing in that direction. I don't think it has a standout track the same way that Mester and Kunze has, but it debatably has even more low-end filth. And yeah, and I think the band, with regards to the low end, the band basically found the last space in their sound where there was room for more violence.
Yeah,
fucking did it. But yeah, that just leaves us to do Mister and Kinsey from 2020. By the way, it translates as the Master's Claw.
Oh,
it's a fucking sinister name, isn't it?
That's pretty metal.
There was a discussion of since Echoes and Dust, an article about it, and some sentiments from that article that I can actually really relate to. It was quite good. The first one, the best way to describe this album is to say that it's utterly singular. Its sound is indicative of a group of real music fans whose taste sprawls across genre boundaries and issue definition.
I get that. That makes sense.
Very accurate. Mm-hmm. The second thing they say is, whilst anything in the kind of blacker death metal vocal range usually sounds like absolute shit to me, for some reason on this album, the vocals don't preclude me from thinking that it's a really excellent album. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was saying earlier on. Like, for a lot of people, when they hear the vocal, they'll be like, nah, I'm out. I would often be in that category. I find that vocal quite laughable sometimes. I definitely find the black metal stuff, as you will tell from the black metal episode if you go back and listen to it, sometimes just absurd, excuse the pun, absurd being a particularly distasteful bunch of black metal cunts. Mm-hmm. But it's laughable at times, but the music in this justifies it to me. The music in this is so rich and dense and complicated and satisfying that I think the affectation of that vocal actually works really well. Mm. Like, it's a bold fucking thing to do, and it will alienate some people, but I think artistically for me, it's a gamble that pays off.
I think I said that in a Black Metal episode as well, so I don't really mind that so much. You know, that vocal approach, it was fine for me. Black Metal's not a style of music that I really hugely enjoy. I'm more into black gaze than anything else, you know, Death Heaven, Liturgy, that kind of thing. And that doesn't really have that kind of vocal. It's kind of different, which is kind of one of the things that separates it from traditional black metal.
Even though in the way that they appropriate it, I don't think they earn it the way that this earns it. Mm. I find the vocal in their music sometimes pretty naff when it's used in that context, but my thoughts on black gaze are on record as well. Anyway, a third point that Echoes and Dust made, and I think it's quite brilliantly put this actually, Aranci Pazuzu have given us something that sounds like a German expressionist horror film served up to you in the midst of a bad trip, parts Nosferatu and parts Tetsuo. Do you know Tetsuo? The Iron Man, the Japanese film.
Oh yeah, I do.
About the guy whose body starts to sprout bursts of metal. And it's horrific, really fucking disgusting movie, black and white, gritty, grimy, traumatic, weirdly beautiful but utterly disgusting at the same time. And Nosferatu, in that kind of classic dark haunted sense, I think it's a brilliant couple of comparisons to make. I think the writer was his name's Puss Grundrich. Kudos to him for that. That was really good. And the fourth point they make, and just because it's a funny take, Aranci Pazuzu are unlike any band you'll ever hear, but they also sound like every band you've ever heard played at the same time.
Yep, that makes sense.
Kerrang also wrote really glowingly of this album. As a multidimensional psychedelic black metal that could soundtrack a trippy psychological horror movie, which is fitting when you learn of the dystopian concept bubbling within, a terrifying future where an evil dictator controls his subjects through mind control. Mm-hmm. I didn't actually know that was the central theme of this. I'd never heard that. I'd never picked up on it at all.
Why would you? It's all in Finnish.
Well, yeah. And there's only one thing that ties in that confirms it to me, so we'll get to that. In terms of this record itself, there's an interesting wee bit of insight, because the band say this record was actually something of a reaction to the Waste of Space Orchestra. Now, Waste of Space Orchestra, I think that was in 2019, and that is the original thing that I spoke about that was commissioned by the guy that runs
Roadburn
Festival, where they united with the other band and wrote 70 minutes of original music, and that is available as a separate album. Now, Onto, aka Tony, from this told Aristocracy, a webzine, that Varahelia was more all over the place, more jammy. After that, we did Waste of Space Orchestra. We had a lot of sounds, 10 musicians. When the other guys left and there were only the five of us, we felt pretty alone and realised there was no way to sound as large and magnificent as Waste of Space Orchestra. So we decided we should go in an opposite direction, more close and aggressive, an in-your-face kind of thing. The atmosphere here is really close and dense. And I think that makes sense, that it's not stripped back, but it's certainly very saturated, but minimalist at points. And yeah, that's a response to the maximalism in terms of arrangement of that other project. Apparently this record also was a debt to Midsommar, you know, the film by Ari Aster, which the whole band all watched prior to it, were really, really into. And he says that they've all fantasised about accompanying that film with music. So this this album has a little bit of that to it. As mentioned in his message, Dave actually turned me on to this band via this record. A couple of people had dropped the name to me, and then it was shortly prior to one of our Christmas episodes where Dave gave me the album. And it, I mean, as you may recall, it was my record of the year during that debauched Christmas special in 2020. And I don't know if it was Dave's record of the year that year, but it was certainly a contender if it wasn't his record of the year. But it remains my favourite, as I say, although that more recent album is pushing it a wee bit. What I didn't realise until doing the research is quite how well the album had gone down. It was quite literally best heavy album of 2020 overall, worldwide, courtesy of some number crunching spreadsheet shagging Redditor called Something Over There, who gathered together more than 100 international metal and hard rock magazines and webzine end of year lists, and he came up with a scoring system, and based on that system this placed top with 166 points. The album Ohms by Deftones was at second overall with 124 points. Napalm Death were third with 112 points. Interesting, Oranssi Pazuzu made 33 of those lists, and the closest was Napalm Death, well behind, with just 21, if you know what I mean. But Oranssi Pazuzu won in every front there. So this album was actually really fucking well received.
Yeah.
Across the board, or at least across the metal board, shall we say. And by the way, in case you're interested, the winner of that same sort of spreadsheet shagging competition the year prior was Blood Incantation.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think all of that, especially that last point about this record being basically the best album, best heavy album of that year, compounds my confusion regarding not just things like play counts, but the fact that the band aren't selling out huge shows, you know, seen them into a quite modest audience before a vastly inferior band recently. It doesn't really sit right with me, you know. I mean, this album was raved about, yet that hasn't, as far as I can tell, really translated into the success that it merits or of the bands around them.
I mean, they're quite an unapproachable outfit. That's, sonically,
I think, you know? Sonically, I think even just in their attitude, I thought there was something really interesting about their demeanour on stage as well. You know, the singer and the keyboard player both have like short hair, don't really look typical of the metal genre. There is something just atypical about them, you know, and I think maybe that confuses writers, I'm not quite sure. But yeah, in terms of the tracks, there's only six of them. I had to go through them quickly. Ilmestush, which I think translates as revelation, it's an objectively minging way to open a record. patient, malignant electronica winding its way in. That snarled, witchy vocal is really clear and really unnerving in this one. At 4 minutes, almost dead on, the track takes a brilliant, really electronic turn, and the tones all get filtered down. You know, it's got this almost subaquatic groove that goes on, and then that erupts again at 5 minutes into this juddering climbing riff. Really unusual way to start the record. Very unsettling.
Yeah, it's kind of got a creepy, kind of foresty, almost pagany atmosphere to it. Like, it evokes that to me. I love the overall feel of the song, to be honest. The synth sounds are really well chosen. The atmosphere is dark and tense, but the song doesn't feel super electronic, even when it is electronic. Does that make sense?
Yep.
And I say that despite the fact there's a lot of different electronic elements that go on there. It feels quite industrial in places to me as a result of that.
Yeah.
It's just really open, like there's quite a lot of space in the mix.
Yeah, you know?
And then it ends with just punishing white noise.
Yeah. The second track, Tihiden Sacramenti, I think that's how it's pronounced. That translates as the Sacrament of Emptiness. It's a long song, it visits a number of places. Sonically, this one initially feels a bit more familiar based on the previous releases. It's got a slowly ramping minor key post-metal made with, you know, traditional instrumentation at this point, guitars, bass, drums, things like that. Yuhu's really quite foul vocal arrives and really drives the menace upwards. And then there's just a momentary sort of musical collapse about 4 minutes 45 where the guitars and bass just completely shift what they're doing. So really nasty, in a good way, touch. There's a sharp drop-off out into a riff at about 6 minutes 10 that would be at home in like 3-1-G. Sounds like noise rock or something like that, which then gives way to a synth pad. And this synth pad is just crushed under the weight of its own vibrato.
Yeah.
Like it's just swelling and just squashing itself down. And the song finishes with washes of electronics and a really funereal beat to it.
No, that's also a really good song. The guitar tones are really good. This song feels less sinister to start off with, but it's still pretty gloomy, don't get me wrong. Like, really dark psychedelia. This is when I made the acid trip, the bad acid trip observation when I was doing my notes that we've come across a few times in this episode. It's exactly the kind of music you don't want to listen to when you're high as fucking paranoid. When the band do come back in about 3 minutes 30, it feels really big, and then it just goes up even higher before it does that fall off around 4 minutes 30 odd. And I really loved that 3-1-G style riff. I really loved that riff, man.
I really didn't see it coming the first time I listened to it.
It actually feels quite rock and roll in terms of the rest of the song. You know, it's quite conventional and it changes the entire feel of the song. But yeah, the synth pads towards the end and the way it just kind of climbs up to this big explosion is a really nice touch.
The third one, Uzi Technokratia, which I think means the new technocracy. We note here, the video for this is that only explicit reference to the supposed dystopian mind control dictator theme that I could see. The video kind of is a bit on the nose with that. This one thunders in with some really brutal krautrock. And when I say krautrock, I don't mean like krautrock for cars. I mean like krautrock for driving a bulldozer at night. It's so crunchy. The electronics flutter around and Juhu's really rotten vocal drifts around your head via the panning. Yeah. you know, in this one, his vocal just ducks about your mind here. And given the tone of his voice and the language barrier and the way it moves around your head, I really do feel like he's putting a curse on me in this one. The drop, this is the one I was saying that has a soft, eerie female vocal in it. That it starts very, very gentle and sparse, and then it starts to it almost sounds like she's hyperventilating. It's a really effective technique. It builds tension in you as a listener. And then there's this monster moment about 4:40, one of the album's best, pure rock fury that comes in.
Yeah, this is a stunning track. The undulating synth part is really fun. It's underpinned by a Motorik, actually, did you use that word, guitar part? It's got a really good texture overall. The song feels like it's stalking you, but you can also kind of bob your head to it, which is odd. And yeah, I noted the vocal processing as well. Sometimes it's down the right channel, occasionally it's in the middle, it bounces between both sides. It's heavily slathered with effects. There's a riff around 250, which is almost post-hardcore, how angular it is. It's just a million miles away from Black Mail at that point. And it has phaser on it, which is a sentence that I would never thought I'd say. It's a nice phaser.
Yeah.
I like the
everyone's second guitar pedal that they get.
Exactly. I like the frantic chaos around 5:20 as well, which gives away to this monolithic metal section that's got a really cool anti-solo in it, which kind of plays for the next couple of minutes. It's just heavy as fuck, that bit. Yeah, it's then I did note the spooky backing vocals towards the end, which give it that psychedelic edge.
Yeah. That's one of those moments where I wouldn't want to be tripping.
Yeah, totally.
Honestly, like, to hear her begin to almost hyperventilate, I just think that would be a fucking horrible thing to be like blazing on.
It kind of fizzles out towards the end and it feels like you're getting a bit of respite. But for me, the song just kind of feels as though it's still going to pop out around the corner. Yeah. You know, the anxiety remains. It's just that you know it's nearby, but you don't know where. You know, it's a really stunning song, like I said.
Say a little prayer for me here, Mark. The fourth track, Oike a Mia Listen, Sally.
Good work. Maybe.
Let's find it. The Hall of the Righteous. Some disconcertingly groovy bass and percussion that's undergirding. Was it a string quartet?
It sounds like a string quartet. Yeah. That actually reminds me of Lancome.
That whole bit is just torn apart at 2:40 by the band coming in. Timing in this one's odd, and there are actually quite a lot of unusual extended bars in this record in general. And even though the arrangement is more typical, you know, the guitar bass drums, it's a tricky sort of timing to follow. The tune again likes lulling you into the grooves and then ripping you out of them. They do that again at, I think it's 4:30, and then they do it again at 5 minutes, which takes us into this enormous expansive passage of kind of high-end splendor. It's quite ethereal and magnificent. I think Godspeed fans will love that bit for sure. It's the most grandiose moment on the album. And predictably unpredictable, they then crush that down into a rhythmic, tribal, percussive closing chapter to this song. It's a long one, but it's got some really fucking good moments on it.
Yeah, it's quite a trippy intro, which does give me trip-hop feels as a result of that. The slowly evolving synth sounds kind of snake its way underneath, which helps add to that trip-hop energy. When the band do come in and the strings become much more twisted and almost yearning sounding, I think that's really cool. To me, it feels like the prelude to a final battle in an epic historical film. You know, it's like you're building up to it. When the violins and cellos and that come back in at 5 minutes, I think it's quite startling.
Yes.
The way that texture is delivered in the sonics of the song. I think it's a beautiful but heart-rending song. you know.
It does. It does have moments of beauty in this one. It's the only one I think that. Well, that's not true. I suppose the last one has sort of hints of that as well. But yeah, they do dare to be a bit elegiac in this one. Now let's get serious, right? The fifth track in this, Kulin Aina Man Alta.
Wow,
I think that's how it's pronounced. Yeah. Anya Man Alta, might be Anya. I think this translates to "I hear sounds" or "I hear voices underground." Creepy title. I'd go so far as to say I think this is the track that elevates this record to the top of the pile for me. I was happy to hear it included live when I went to see them recently, although I'm perplexed having then gone on Spotify and seen that it's one of the lower listen counts on this record alone. It definitely has kraut aspects, but it also has a lot of industrial to
it. A lot of industrial.
Yeah. The sampled backwards melody in it and those nasty, it's like pitch bent brass blasts give this song a whole new layer of complexity and unease.
Yeah.
The drum pattern accrues really subtly, you know, little things join it, evolving. The whole thing seems to build and intensify in a really subtle fashion. I just think it's such a mature bit of like gradation up the way. Subtle that is until 2:40 when this absolutely furious bass part punches its way into your skull. The dissonant guitar work and then that minor key arp that comes in, heaps it on top. I really just love basking in the hellishness of the song at that point. I mean, it is fucking grim as fuck at that, and I wish they'd gone longer with it, because at 3:50 it gives way, just that kind of arp remains and there's this distinctly non-metal percussive pattern that takes over. The song then kind of toys with those elements and then very gradually slides out of view. It kind of leaves this glassy synth trail as well. I think this song is their single best work. I mean, I think it's an absolutely fantastic bit of music. This was the one that when Dave gave me this to listen to, it had it on in the background and it was just like, stop what you're doing. What the fuck is this? This is incredible. I really love it.
That's a great bit of music. It has trip hop at the start. It then feels like electronic rock and then it becomes industrial rock almost. It's got synth wavy synths in it when the arpeggiators come in later on. It's got lots of weird noises and lead guitar is quite noisy, loads of bends in it, which feels quite Nine Inch Nails to me. When it all drops out and it becomes electronic drums, it again feels very synth wavy and it becomes that kind of ambient outro. And the synth sound there reminds me of Tubular Bells. It's very 70s, very psychedelic at the end. Yeah, it's a song that's got a lot of movements to it, which go in really weird directions and you would never think to jam all those things together, but they totally do and it really works.
It's, I mean, from memory, I think it's sitting about 460,000 listens on Spotify. It's fucking mental to me that a song this good is there when you consider where other works that are nowhere even close to it are.
Yeah.
I mean, it fucking blows my fucking mind. That Soljav Stair band that they supported, one of their videos on YouTube is on 7 million views. I mean, this track is infinitely fucking better than that. Infinitely better than that. I was pleased that it's such a prominent role in their live set, because I think certainly the band, and it seemed like the people around me that were into the band got it. They were like, this is a phenomenal track. This can't be left out of our live show. And like me, I was, when they started playing it, I was like one of those ones where you yell at the start of the track because you're so excited about it. Yeah, this track alone makes it unsung to me. I don't get why everybody doesn't know this. And then the final track, Ty Van Porty, Gateway to Heaven. I mean, how the fuck do you follow?
I don't know. How is that even a Gateway to Heaven? It's a black metal song.
Yeah. Well, actually, I've got a musing on that. But first of all, this track had the unenviable task of following the last track. How do you do that? I mean, a song called Gateway to Heaven sounds very much like you're going the other direction, though. This tune is minging. It is fucking
it's proper
grim.
Black metal.
It quickly launches into that unusually punctuated black metal guitar, synth frenzy. It basically holds that ferocity throughout. Mm-hmm. I think the glimpses of the heaven referred to in the title are via those euphoric moments of synths.
Yeah.
They kind of manifest in the background and then dissipate like clouds. Like suddenly you realise, oh, that's actually quite nice, that backing bit. And it doesn't just stop. It just sort of gradually evaporates into something nasty again. It never allows itself to get too sweet, but there is a wee bit of a twisted majesty at play in it. In the context, I actually feel like this song kind of implies a fairly negative take on the merits of heaven. Now, I'm really, what's the word, projecting a lot here. But Gateway to Heaven, listening to such a horrendously pessimistic tune with a title like that, it makes me think, you know, the sheer magnificent horror of heaven, the grotesque implications of there even being a heaven. All right, so that means that, first of all, there's a hell where who knows who is suffering unbelievable woes, but also all this stuff that happened on earth happened by design. Like, you made this awful stuff happen. So this idea that heaven is somehow good news, it's like, no, heaven's terrible news, because that means that all those fucking childhood leukemias and fucking unbaptized children trapped forever in fucking purgatory. Like, heaven's really bad news, if you think about it in that sense. And yeah, as ending goes, it just, this tune just leaves you feeling absolutely fucked. Like, just plain tired. And not in the sense of boredom. I mean, like, in the sensory emotional overload of the track.
Exhausting.
Tony himself, agreed in an interview saying that, I think that Ty Van Porty is so heavy and demanding that it could only be the last track, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great bit of music, black metal intro. It's got the blast beats, the tremolo, all of the a bunch of bends. It feels really dynamic. The synth sounds are quite fun in it, and it feels like, they also feel like a carryover for the last tune, which is cool.
Yeah.
But the song, as you say, is very unrelenting, and it keeps that feel even when the vocals come in. Around 2 minutes 39, there's a shouted vocal which is properly hideous. It sounds like a guy screaming from the bottom of a well. It's just so cavernous and layered with reverb and buried way deep in the mix, and then it decays and then fritters away in a mass of, you know, when you use a reverb pedal when you turn it all the way up and it just kind of makes that sort of spacey kind of weird sound, does that. I love how unrelenting and horrible this song is. It just builds in the same pattern over and over and over again, and then it burns itself out, which is what I really enjoyed about it. It feels like it just loses all its energy at the end and falls apart. It's just a really great ending to what I think is a really good album.
The conclusion for me, I mean, I think we're dealing with a really special band. I love the fact that the new record's so good, arguably just as good as this, that it seems like they're still in an upward trajectory. There are groups out there doing similar bits here and there, you know, and Oransi Pazuzu's influences are evident despite the diversity, but whilst I share a love of a lot of those bits, I've never heard them brought together like this, you know. And this, the band neither feel try hard nor corny in their grimness. We talked about that with the vocal. I think they pull that off. It sounds genuinely unsettling. There's a pervasive sense of malice that is just fucking delicious all the way through the records. And as I say, whilst a few records could maybe vied for the crown, the relative brevity of Mester and Kinsey is a big advantage as well.
For sure.
And the ace card of Cullen, Anya, Manalta just pips the others for me thus far. They may go on to do even better.
Yeah, really good album, really good choice. I'm glad I listened to it, glad I got to terms with their discography as well. I will go back to listen them. I will go back to listen to them for sure.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm exhausted though. They are exhausting.
They are an exhausting, challenging listen, but that's also kind of why it feels so worthwhile, because there's a lot of nutrition in it.
Yeah.
An awful lot of nutrition in it.
Yeah, it keeps unveiling new things every single time you listen to it.
Yeah. Well, you'll be happy to know we're not doing an Exodus this week.
We're not doing an Exodus this week. Anything, any thoughts on what we're doing next week? Final one of the year, probably. Yes, we are taking a break over the Christmas period, unless you're a subscriber.
Yeah, if you're a subscriber, there'll be no break. In fact, there will be maximal hilarity in the Christmas episodes. If you do want to hear the Christmas episodes, where we have a drink and we answer questions, and Dave will be with us, then subscribe. You can subscribe at the
Patreon.
I didn't actually mean location. I more meant you can subscribe at the midden level.
Ah, yes, the midden level.
Just $4 a month.
$4 or whatever your local
munters only is, like us. And that's enough. That's enough to get you through the gates. But yeah, and that way you'll be able to not only ask us questions, but then appreciate those episodes. Otherwise, we will be going into the vault and pulling a few of probably the earlier episodes for people that aren't familiar with them and are a wee bit daunted by the scale of the back catalogue at this point. We'll probably pull a few of those up over Christmas.
Yes.
But yeah, we will maybe squeeze in a wee interview next week.
Maybe. Let's see. Well, thank you for joining us as ever. Like and subscribe, please, on this YouTube channel if we're on it. If we're not on it, then give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, please.
And
thank you.
Yeah, the only word I know in Finnish is hello.